Chapter 13. On February 12, 1964, 20 months before her tragic death, Dorothy Kilgallen and more than 400 reporters from around the world passed through the entrance of the Dallas County Courthouse as a light rain forced umbrellas to be a necessity. At a few minutes before 9 a.m., Melvin Belli entered the courtroom. The dour-faced, stooped Jack Ruby joined him and co-counsel Joe Tonahill at counsel table. At the pretrial hearing, Belli stood and with his booming voice in full force addressed Judge Joe Brown. When asked how Ruby pled to the charge of first-degree murder, Belli stated loud and clear, "Not guilty by reason of psychomotor epilepsy insanity." Hearing the news, Kilgallen's face froze in shock, her mind puzzled by Belli's intended defense. Chief Trial Prosecutor Bill Alexander told this author, "I could not understand Belli's strategy. It made no sense." 3 days later, Kilgallen and Belli, both staying at the Statler Hilton Dallas Hotel, enjoyed a lively dinner where he boasted of his trial triumphs and she tried to pry information from him about Ruby's defense. Kilgallen asked if she could interview Ruby. Belli told her that it was impossible. No member of the media was permitted to do so. She asked again. Belli said no again. 9 days later, Belli and Ruby were the featured performers in the February 21st, 1964 issue of Life magazine, featuring the infamous and controversial photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald brandishing his rifle on the cover. The magazine touted headlines reading, "Exclusive, Oswald armed for murder, in full and extraordinary detail, the life of the assassin." Below the caption, the blurb read, "As Jack Ruby goes to trial, cast of characters, how the law applies." An accompanying photograph caption read, "As Ruby goes to trial, the question before the court, was this man sane?" District Attorney Henry Wade, when asked about the insanity defense, replied, "We think this is a case of cold-blooded, calculated murder." Still sorting out her strategy regarding how to cover the Ruby trial, Kilgallen, in a biting Journal American column of February 21st, noted the government's refusal to provide the Ruby defense team requested documents. After quoting a governmental reply to Belli's co-counsel, Joe Tonahill, she wrote, "Say that again, slowly. Information concerning Oswald's assassination of the president will not be available." Perhaps it is dramatizing to say that there is an Orwellian note in that line. But it does make you think, doesn't it? It appears that Washington knows or suspects something about Lee Harvey Oswald that it does not want Dallas and the rest of the world to know or suspect. Lee Harvey Oswald has passed on not only to his shuddery reward, but to the mysterious realm of classified persons whose whole story is known only to a few government agents. Why is Oswald being kept in the shadows, as dim a figure as they can make him, while the defense tries to rescue his alleged killer with the help of information from the FBI? Who is Oswald anyway? Little doubt exists Kilgallen attempted to aid the defense so as to cozy up to Belli, reluctant as he had been to any potential for the famous reporter to interview Ruby. By damning the government for resisting demands for additional information about Oswald, she had done the defense a favor by making the dispute public. At the same time, Kilgallen made the prosecutors look bad by providing the impression that they were hiding vital evidence. Since Kilgallen appeared to be escalating her investigation, both Mark Sinclair and James Clement expressed their concern that danger was lurking with every accusatory word she wrote. No matter, her strategy worked, since Belli boasted to Tonahill about gaining Kilgallen's continuing cooperation. It may also be assumed that Ruby noted Kilgallen's help, greasing the skids for his cooperation down the line, when she once again asked for interviews with Oswald's killer. Meanwhile, Belli was in lawyer heaven, his star shining brightly as excerpts from the Life magazine story, with its implication that Ruby was insane, hit the newspapers in Dallas, where prospective jurors lived. Later, Tannehill criticized Belli's insanity defense. Every one of his colleagues did as well. According to author interviews with Belli's associate Seymour Ellison and Tannehill's daughter Rebecca, Belli refused to alter the strategy despite the skeptics. Right on cue, the same day as Kilgallen's pro-defense column was published, she once again begged Belli for an interview with Ruby. He once again told her this was impossible, but her persuasive charm began to thaw his resistance. When Belli mentioned his interest in a career as an actor, Kilgallen sensed a trade of sorts. She could provide Hollywood contacts in exchange for the Ruby interview, the big prize, one Kilgallen intended to capture at all costs. Meanwhile, at his Virginia home, far away from the Kilgallen-Belli rendezvous, RFK, despite the frigid temperature, sat with wife Ethel by the pool at his home. He read works by Shakespeare, Emerson, Thoreau, Albert Camus, Greek philosophers, and classicist Edith Hamilton, who had been suggested by Jackie Kennedy. From Hamilton's The Greek Way, which he carried with him, RFK selected a passage to remember. The gods, who hated beyond all else the arrogance of power, had passed judgment on him. Later, Bobby read one Bible verse from Genesis 4:10 that haunted him. The voice of my brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. As Bobby mourned out of guilt, Kilgallen's February 24th Journal American column provided readers with a whopper of a story about the Ruby trial. Under the headline, DA to Link Ruby to Oswald, she wrote, among those who know the seamier side of Dallas show business, the betting is 10-1 that District Attorney Hank Wade will produce witnesses who will testify that Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald were acquainted. Ruby has said repeatedly that he didn't know the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. But then Ruby's plea is temporary insanity, and there are a great many things he doesn't remember and isn't about to. Kilgallen, having referred to Oswald as an alleged assassin, then added, to quote one observer, the operation of Jack's Carousel Club had its unsavory aspects, but if Oswald checked in there a couple of nights a week, he could have made some extra money. That would account for his ability to take trips, like the one to Mexico, on a $50 a week salary. And it would also account for his lying in a room in the heart of Dallas 5 nights a week and joining his wife and children in the suburbs only on Fridays and Saturdays. Author research has not uncovered any noticeable reaction from other members of the press to this lethal column from Kilgallen's typewriter. Regardless, as the days passed during the Ruby trial and beyond, and in fact for decades to come, the skilled journalist's proposition that the DA was intending to link Ruby and the man he assassinated in cold blood received little attention, since connecting the two men obviously pointed squarely in the direction of the conspiracy J. Edgar Hoover did not want to admit existed. The failure of the press to pounce on even the possibility that Kilgallen, the lone voice of dissent, was right, provides a strong example that for some reason, journalists turned their back on a true search for the truth as to what happened in Dallas. As Kilgallen's shocking column faded into the sun without making much noise, jury selection began for the Jack Ruby trial. Kilgallen had prepared herself for a high-profile case like this since the early days at the Evening Journal. To date, she had covered 4 of the most headline-making trials of the 20th century. Bruno Hauptmann, Dr. Sam Shepard, Dr. Bernard Finch, and John Profumo. Kilgallen had written hundreds of articles and columns while learning the ins and outs of the criminal justice system. Predictably, Kilgallen, after Mark Sinclair and James Clement had warned her to be careful in Dallas, made her appearance on the grandest stage of all amidst much attention. She was a national celebrity, whose very presence added to the gala appearance of the trial. Autograph seekers lined the halls before deputies shooed them away. Noted columnist Bob Considine, who was originally selected as the chief Journal American reporter to cover the trial, wrote, "Dorothy Kilgallen arrived in court yesterday and stopped the show. Judge Joe B. Brown, one of her fans, gallantly granted, yea, insisted, on an interview in his chambers. Melvin Belli of San Francisco and Joe Tonahill of Jasper, Texas, took her to lunch at a nearby seafood house named Vincent's, whose oysters, Belli declared, are the best this side of his native city's Fisherman's Wharf." Jim Lehrer of the Dallas Times-Herald escorted Kilgallen around the courthouse. He later became a co-anchor on PBS's NewsHour. Lehrer interviewed Kilgallen regarding Dallas's responsibility for JFK's death. She said, "I don't see why Dallas should feel guilty for what one man, or even three or five in a conspiracy, have done." One may only imagine that hearing of Kilgallen's quote must have caused the blood pressure of J. Edgar Hoover and those who had been involved in JFK's, and yes, Oswald's death, to increase a hundredfold. All of the other journalists, lambs who were following the company line toward Oswald alone, were behaving themselves, but not Dorothy May Kilgallen. Why? Because she had used the dreaded C word, conspiracy. And to Hoover and those he must have known were responsible for JFK's death, this was cause for a possible heart attack. Although Kilgallen had visited Dealey Plaza before, she did so again on a cold and windy morning before court convened. With her trusty file papers in hand, she stood across from the Texas School Book Depository and noted the angle between where JFK was shot and the sixth-floor window where Oswald had allegedly fired his Carcano rifle. She made a note that there appeared to be a tree blocking any possible shooting before gazing at the infamous grassy knoll area and the overpass nearby. No column appears to have been written about whatever conclusions she reached, but perhaps this was meant to happen at a later date. On the same day, Earl Ruby, avoiding Kilgallen, cornered Melvin Belli outside the courtroom. Earl, at Jack's insistence, explained that his brother was disappointed with the insanity plea. He wanted another lawyer, Charles Tesmer, to be co-counsel. Belli yelled at Earl, refusing any consideration of the matter. The night before, Kilgallen, still seeking ammunition as to how she might interview Ruby, welcomed a phone call from a woman in San Francisco. Realizing what she learned might open the door, she decided to approach Joe Tonahill instead of Belli. Despite the presence of 400 reporters from, among others, the Chicago Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, New York Herald Tribune, National Observer, Life, Time, and the Saturday Evening Post, Kilgallen was determined to succeed where the others had failed, since she knew many of them were begging to interview Oswald's killer. The next morning, at the defense counsel table in an otherwise empty Dallas courtroom, Kilgallen approached Tonahill and told him that a good friend of Ruby, a San Francisco opera singer, had sent along her best wishes. She added that the opera singer had asked Kilgallen to speak privately with Ruby, whom Tonahill said had watched What's My Line on his Carousel Club TV. He insisted on absolute privacy and a quiet atmosphere when listening to his favorite, Kilgallen. In a videotaped interview, Tonahill described how Kilgallen became Ruby's only interviewer at trial. "She told me she had had a contact with a friend of Jack's from San Francisco," Tonahill said. "I believe it was an opera singer that he was very fond of. She wanted to pass a message along to him." I told Jack that, and he said, I'd like to talk to Kilgallen. Tannehill explained, Jack had a bodyguard shield around him of 4 deputy sheriffs sitting behind him and everywhere he went, and I told them Kilgallen wanted to ask him some questions and speak with him at recess, and that he'd agreed to it. And they said, okay. Tannehill added, so when the judge declared the noon recess, Jack went over and spoke with her, in the courtroom right behind his chair where he was sitting. There was a rail there, and he got up, and she was on the other side of the rail, and Jack was on this side, and they had a little conversation. I think the press had already left the courtroom. Asked how long Kilgallen and Ruby spoke, Tannehill replied, about 5 minutes. Interview available at thedorothykilgallenstory.org. Told that Earl Ruby denied Kilgallen had ever interviewed his brother. I asked Sheriff Bill Decker, and he said she never had an interview with Jack. Tannehill said, I don't know why Earl would make that statement, because it's absolutely untrue. Bill Decker, the sheriff, knew about the interview. The officers told him about it after I told them, and they went to their boss, and the boss said, okay. Tannehill added, Kilgallen started out saying this opera singer in San Francisco had spoken to her about Jack, and she wanted to tell him something. I didn't pay much attention to what they were saying. Asked if Tannehill knew the name of the opera singer, he said no, but then added, Jack was pretty enthusiastic about the opera singer, so they must have been pretty close friends. Once the interview began, Kilgallen, who had spent a mostly sleepless night in anticipation of the encounter, looked directly into Ruby's weary face. She noticed his hands were shaking. She said they chatted for 8 minutes. Kilgallen left the courtroom with pages of notes, her mind racing with the secret information Oswald's killer had given her. In a small anteroom nearby, she checked and rechecked the notes, making sure what she had written was accurate. That the interview had taken place at all surprised her, due to a December 2, 1963 Journal American column she had written under the misleading title, Slain Beauty Never Dreamed of Danger. Kilgallen stated, Jack Ruby, killer of Lee Harvey Oswald, didn't leave Chicago for Dallas because he yearned for the fresh air of Texas. He limped out of the Windy City after being taken for a ride by the boys and left for dead. At the time, he was an active hoodlum in a very lucrative laundry shakedown racket. This wording upset Ruby, and during a subsequent medical interview, he said, I did like Dorothy Kilgallen until she wrote a column saying I was a gangster, so I don't like her now. Regardless, Kilgallen had her exclusive interview in hand, and she celebrated with several vodka tonics in the hotel bar. Back in her hotel room, the perplexed reporter typed her Journal American story for February 23, 1964. Under the banner, A Dorothy Kilgallen Exclusive, she chose the headline, Nervous Ruby Feels Breaking Point Near. The first paragraph read, Jack Ruby's eyes were as shiny brown and white, bright as the glass eyes of a doll. He tried to smile, but his smile was a failure. When we shook hands, his hand trembled in mine ever so slightly, like the heartbeat of a bird. Continuing, Kilgallen wrote, I'm nervous and worried, he told me. I feel I'm on the verge of something I don't understand. The breaking point, maybe. When Kilgallen told Ruby, I think you're holding up pretty well, he replied, I'm fooling you, Dorothy. I'm really scared. To explain the circumstances surrounding how she garnered the exclusive interview, Kilgallen wrote, I had stayed behind because I had been told that Ruby would like to talk to me. In a short while, co-counsel Joe Tannehill beckoned to me, and I went up to the defense table. Jack would like to talk to you, he said. Jack rose politely to shake hands, his eyes glistening and his mouth smiling, but the total effect inexpressively sad. It's wonderful to see you, Dorothy, were his first words. Kilgallen ended the article by writing, I went out into the almost empty lunchroom corridor, wondering what I really believed about this man. Why Kilgallen did not mention the involvement of the opera singer was undoubtedly due to protecting the woman's identity. Why she made it seem like Ruby asked to speak to her may have been to blunt any disparaging remarks from fellow reporters upset over the special treatment she received, since interviewing Ruby was a scoop of immense proportions. Hour by hour, day by day, Kilgallen was on the prowl. She was digging for the truth, intent on destroying what she perceived as the myth of Hoover's Oswald alone theory by attempting to connect the major players in the assassinations. Oswald, Ruby, and whoever she believed masterminded JFK and Oswald's deaths. She was, despite Mark Sinclair and James Clements' apprehensions, like the rat chasing the cheese, diving into areas of interest no other reporter dared to explore, and then pouring what she had learned into lethal columns, scaring those who feared her most. Her weapon was her words, scalding, fighting words to those attempting to cover up the truth. But the more she investigated, the more dangerous it became, especially for those who knew she was writing a tell-all book for Random House, the dagger that would expose the conspirators. Now the Ruby trial was on the horizon. What would she learn firsthand from sworn witnesses? What additional evidence would confirm her suspicions, causing her to continue to probe and probe some more as the days passed? As Kilgallen looked on from a front-row seat, the Ruby trial testimony commenced on March 4, 1964. Several DPD police officers were called to the witness stand by prosecutors Henry Wade and Bill Alexander. They established Ruby had acted with premeditation before killing Oswald. Kilgallen's suspicion about Belli's defense had first surfaced in a February 21, 1964 column when she wrote, "Ruby's plea is temporary insanity, and there are a great many things Ruby doesn't remember and isn't about to." The "isn't about to" quote was revealing. It apparently meant Kilgallen believed that Ruby, regardless of his mental state, was being ordered to keep certain information secret. While Kilgallen made plans to interview Ruby once again at the jail, with stagnant air permeating a small attorney's conference room adorned with blue plastic chairs and a white table with ketchup stains abounding, Oswald's killer asked Belli to let him testify. His voice bellowing with indignation, the pompous attorney refused the request. He explained that the doctors were their best witnesses. He told Ruby he would get tricked if he testified. Ruby was upset. He started yelling at his counsel as the argument ensued. Ruby said, "I'm not crazy, Mel. You know I'm not." Belli asked Ruby to trust him. He reluctantly did so, his hands twitching, his face crimson with anger, as thunder roared outside the building. Before court the next day, Kilgallen spoke with Judge Joe Brown. He agreed to allow her to conduct the private interview with Ruby away from the courtroom. The accused killer Kilgallen intended to interview was a complex man, according to Stephen Austin, who knew Ruby during the 1950s. In 2017, Austin told this author, "Ruby had his club across the street from the Adolphus Hotel. My friend Breck Wall had a show at the Century Room there, and he and Jack became friends." Austin added, "Several times I went with Breck over to Jack's club, a real dump, not classy. They always ended up in a verbal fight about something. Jack was like a gangster from some movies. Slicked back, greasy, oily black hair. Short-tempered. A mafia-type guy, always dressed in black." After noting that Wall was one of the first people to visit Ruby in jail, Austin said, "Jack wanted to see him. Jack called me the kid." A small office nearby was chosen for Kilgallen to interview the gangster, Austin described. Ruby's guards and Joe Tonahill waited outside after Belli had given the go-ahead. Kilgallen spoke to Oswald's cold-blooded killer for less than 10 minutes. To friends, she acknowledged the meeting, but never the substance of the conversation, apparently at Ruby's request. Whatever Oswald's assassin told Kilgallen thus remained a secret, with the information noted in her ever-expanding assassination file. On March 10, 1964, Kilgallen listened carefully to three psychiatrists Belli presented for the defense. They included Yale's Dr. Roy Schaefer. He testified regarding Ruby's unstable mental state before he shot Oswald. Kilgallen was skeptical of his findings in light of the second interview with Ruby. While Kilgallen was absent from the courtroom, KRLD Radio's Wes Wise talked to Ruby. Wise asked Ruby if he wanted to testify. Ruby nodded yes. He then told Wise, "But Belli knows best." At the Justice Department, Robert Kennedy met with Kilgallen's friend, White House Press Secretary Pierre Salinger. Afterwards, Salinger told a colleague that Bobby was the most shattered man he had ever seen in his life. He is virtually non-functioning. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Arthur Schlesinger agreed. The author told Salinger, RFK refused to involve himself in the question of who murdered his brother. Salinger said Bobby did not want any investigation. He had left Katzenbach to deal with the Warren Commission. The next day, as Kilgallen looked on, Belli further questioned Dr. Roy Schaefer about Ruby's mental state. While doing so, Belli mistakenly called his client Oswald. Judge Joe Brown shook his head in disgust. This was the fifth time Belli had mixed up his client with JFK's alleged assassin. Kilgallen was also curious about Belli's miscues. In her hotel room, she worked on her book, Murder One. She was still uncertain whether the Ruby case would be included or part of a separate book. During the late afternoon hours of March 12th, Belli stunned Kilgallen and the other reporters. He formally rested Ruby's defense without permitting him to testify. After the trial, Ruby affirmed to the media, "I wanted to tell my story." Belli's decision caught not only Kilgallen and the media off guard, but the jury as well. Jury foreman Max Causey, the first juror chosen, later wrote, "The biggest shock of the trial came when Mr. Belli rose to his feet and told the court, 'The defense rests.' I don't think we were any more surprised than the prosecution. I looked over at them to see what they were going to do now, and I noticed that they appeared to be taken completely by surprise." Wayman Rose, another juror, said he was stunned by the surprise development.
"Exhausted at the end of the day, a worn-down Belli," described later by Agent C.D. Deloach in a 1980 FBI memorandum as obviously a mentally disturbed and intemperate attorney,
who served as defense counsel for Jack Ruby, sat with chauffeur and friend Milton Hunt in their hotel bar. In a low tone, Belli startled Hunt by confessing, as Hunt told this author, "The Ruby case is fixed. I'm just going through the motions. It's simply being staged for the sake of publicity." Belli, according to Hunt, added, "There's an inside thing and no way to win. It's a whitewash." Troubled by Belli's admissions, Hunt told this author, "I considered informing the court or Ruby's family or someone both at the end of the trial and afterwards. But I knew Mel would deny he ever told me the case was fixed." Regardless, the next morning, Kilgallen read the Dallas Morning News headline, "Final arguments set in Ruby trial. Big question, was Ruby crazy?"